made me. Our guest on The Year That Made Me today is the author of a book whose title is a statement that feels like it captures something profound about the times we live in. One day, everyone will have always been against this. For more than 20 years, Egyptian-Canadian Omar El-Akkad worked as a journalist, reporting from places like Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay. He's also published two critically acclaimed novels, American War in 2017 and What Strange Paradise, which won the Giller Prize in 2021. One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This is described by his publisher as a heartsick breakup letter with the West. Omar El-Akkad, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we start talking about your life, could we talk about that title? When did you first coin that phrase, and how and why did it end up being the title of your latest book?
Yeah, it's a really strange thing because, as you're about to find out from my rambling answers, I'm not very much a short form kind of person. So
nailed it with those 9 words.
yeah, right. I don't do Twitter that well. I've sort of left social media altogether. But in sort of late October 2023, I had posted something along the lines of, you know, one day when it's safe, when there's no downside to calling a thing what it is, when it's too late to hold anyone accountable, everyone will have always been against this. And I was referring, of course, to the slaughter in Gaza, which went on for another 2 years, essentially. And I honestly have no idea why that sentiment gained the traction it did. But, you know, as they say, it went viral. Sorry, I sound so old right now. I sound so old saying that. The interesting thing about it is that this book was sort of, I was writing that independently of anything to do with that tweet. And originally the title of the book was The Glass Coffin. I was thinking about this idea of in situations of great asymmetry of power, how one of the most offensive things the oppressed can do is to simply show the body, to show what is happening. And so the first draft of the book was written under that title. And it was only later that one of my editors suggested repurposing the line from the tweet as the title. So that's how it came about. I promise you I didn't take a tweet and stretch it out to 250 pages. That's not how it came about.
Yeah. As I said, your publisher describes the book as a heartsick breakup letter with the West. How would you describe it, Omar?
Yeah, I have a little bit of trouble with that description because I'm not sure if I agree or disagree with it. I honestly don't know. Institutionally, I think it's absolutely correct. I think one of the things that has changed fundamentally in me as a person over the last 2 years is my respect for or belief in or expectations of the institutional load-bearing beams of the Western world. I'm talking political, journalistic, academic, cultural. You know, at the same time, I've seen so many people in the same part of the world do incredibly courageous things to stand up against what is happening. And so that's why I have a little bit of trouble with that description of it, because I think institutionally it's spot on. A lot of this book is about taking leave of a lot of these institutions that I believed in, but not so much in terms of the people themselves.
Tell us a bit about your life story, Omar. Where were you born and how is it that you ended up living in Canada?
So I was born in Egypt. My family is Egyptian, going back many, many generations, particularly on my father's side. Just before my 5th birthday, or actually around the time I was about 4 years old, my father was coming home one night from work in Cairo and was stopped by 2 soldiers who were just bored. They decided to give him a hard time just for fun. And he got lucky that his boss was leaving around the same time, and his boss happened to be friends with the soldiers and convinced them to let him go. And I think for him, that was the last straw. You know, my father loved Egypt, but he needed to get out. And so he found a job in Libya, of all places. He goes to the airport, and it turns out that someone with the same name is on a Libyan terrorism watch list. So he's denied entry. A little while later, he gets another job offer in this place called Qatar, which is where he ends up, where we all end up, and where I spend the next 11 years of my life. Qatar, as some of your listeners might know, is pound for pound maybe the richest country on earth. And so I end up growing up in the richest country on earth instead of Libya because of a case of mistaken identity at the airport. And that's the reason I sound like this, because I've been going to American and British schools since the age of 5. The thing with Qatar is that eventually you have to leave. If you're not Qatari born, you're on a work permit and eventually you have to get out. My father saw this coming many years later and he decided to immigrate to Canada, a place we knew nothing about. And that's where I ended up at the age of 16, and I've been living in North America ever since.
You described that experience that your father had outside the Cairo Sheraton as the memory that anchors your overarching view of political malice. What do you mean by that?
So my dad told me about this story and then didn't talk to me about it very much for a very long time. And the thing I remember taking from it was this notion that there was this overarching commonality in all forms of insidious political behavior, which is this idea that somebody in a position of power can stop you and ask you to prove why you exist in that context, in that situation, sometimes why you exist at all. So, you know, the first thing they did when they stopped him was say, show us your papers. And he took out his little ID card because at the time, under martial law, you needed sort of a special dispensation to be out at night. And my father, because he worked in the tourism industry, had that dispensation. So he gives them his little ID card. And the soldier, without looking at it, tears it up, throws it on the ground and says, show us your papers. And in so many points in my life, later on when I became a journalist, when I, you know, reported from war zones, and now, to be quite honest with you, living in the United States under the Trump administration, that common display of political power, that very malicious display of political power, always feels the same. That somebody can stop you and say, by virtue of the power of the state, I now put the onus on you to prove to me why you need to exist. That has been a common thread through much of the worst things that I have seen in my lifetime.
What sort of a view did you have of the West, if not Canada, when you moved there, and where did those views come from?
So for the first 16 years of my life, I was attuned to the Western world, you know, particularly the UK and the US, which is where I sort of, I grew up on the culture of those places. You know, you'd smuggle in whatever records or books or movies you could and hope that nobody checked your bags at the airport when you were coming back into Qatar. But I sort of grew up on the culture of those places. And I think for the first 16 years of my life, if you had asked me what those places or the conception of those places means to me, I would have given you a very active answer. Freedom of speech, freedom of expression, the cultural output, so on and so forth. And the more I think about it in hindsight, the more I think that what I actually valued the most was not so much what these places were as what they weren't. So it was more of a negative space, which is to say that I was growing up in a country where the films were censored, the TV shows were censored, the magazines were censored. And all I really needed was for a different place to not be that. And so for a long time, the West existed as the lure of this kind of negative space. I don't know what the hell it is, but I have a pretty good idea of what it isn't. And I can go there and I can be left alone to think what I want, to read what I want, et cetera, et cetera. And that, I think, for me was the primary lure. And I think for a lot of people, it's the primary lure. Like for me, it was cultural. You know, what culture am I consuming? For a lot of people, it's political. Who's not going to come knocking at my door and that sort of thing? But it's always a kind of negation of the experience that you are having a hard time putting up with in your present state.
On The Year That Made Me, we're speaking with Omar El-Akkad, whose most recent book is One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This. Omar, what was it like for you to move to Canada? Canada to Qatar is a pretty serious culture change.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it. We left on the last day of August in 1998, where the temperature, if I recall correctly, was pushing 50.
Yeah, forget about culture. It's the temperature's the big contrast.
Yep. No, there's nothing culturally that compares, because within about 3 months, I'm standing in downtown Montreal and it's minus 40. And I cannot begin to tell you how much I hated Canada for a very long time. I think with anyone going through adolescence, you're sort of building a skill set for how to get through the world. and the entire skill set that I had built up over the first 16 years of my life suddenly became completely irrelevant. I don't remember if I put this in the book or not, but the first time I got on a city bus in Montreal, I tried to jam a $20 bill into the coin slot. I'd never been on a city bus before. Public transit essentially did not exist in Qatar when I lived there. Taxes were this alien thing. What do you mean taxes? Just take the oil revenue. Sidewalks. Nobody walked in Qatar when I lived there. Starting over at 16, it's not the worst thing, but it's not great. And it took me several years to try and figure out who the hell I was, because a lot of what I was showing up in Canada became irrelevant. So, you know, it was a tough few years.
And I think it's in this area that you've chosen the year that made you. I thought you might have chosen 2023, but you haven't chosen that year. What year have you chosen, Omar, and why?
People are going to hear a Muslim guy named Omar on your show, and they're going to think, yeah, 2001. It was, you know, like, I get it. I get all of that. But in a lot of ways, that year changed the trajectory of my life. I showed up in college at Queen's University, which is sort of three, four hours outside Toronto in Canada. I showed up to pursue a computer science degree. All I've ever wanted to do is be a writer. And I also come from a particular background, and I think any immigrants listening to your show will be familiar with this, where you don't really become a writer. You don't become a painter. You become a lawyer or an engineer or a doctor. And I think computer science was my way of trying to split that difference. And from the very first class, I realized that I was useless at this. I couldn't program my way out of a paper bag. And instead of trying to do anything about it, I just sort of stopped going to class. And in the summer of 2001, between first and second year, essentially, at university, I found out that there was this creative writing class that was being offered as an elective by the poet Carolyn Smart. And you couldn't just apply, you couldn't just sort of sign up for it. You had to be accepted, and you had to hand in a piece of writing, and then she would accept, you know, 15 students or whatever it was. And so I sat down in this very dinky basement apartment that I was sharing with my then girlfriend, now wife, and I wrote this piece that was, and I cannot stress this enough, complete trash, just the worst piece of writing you'll ever read. And for some reason, Carolyn Smart took pity on me and allowed me to go into that class. And she quickly became my mentor, the first writer I ever met who was a professional writer, who was making a living off of their work. And she changed the trajectory of my life. And all of that happened in 2001. So that's my very roundabout way of saying it's not a bad year to pick.
Yeah, so clearly a really significant development in your vocation, a sense of possibility of becoming who you wanted to be. But also, of course, 2001 as a year is seared in pretty well everyone's memory as the year of the September 11 attacks. And I can only imagine that for someone like you, had a huge impact, as it would have on your whole family. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so those creative writing classes were every Tuesday. And the first creative writing class, the very first one of the year, was on Tuesday, September 11th, 2001. And I woke up in my dinky little basement apartment, and I was checking my Hotmail account at the time, because this is a very long time ago now. And there was an email from a high school friend of mine who had gone on to Columbia. She was studying at Columbia University. And the email just said something like, "Hey, everybody, just wanted to let you know that I'm safe." And I thought, okay, are you going to send this every week? Like, you're safe, that's fine, you know. And of course, you know, I got up and turned on the TV and realized what was happening. And one of my memories of that day was actually the next thing I had to do was go to that creative writing class. And we're sitting there, and it's, I think, 10 or 15 kids. You know, we were kids. We were, I think, 18, 19 years old. And just not fully understanding what was happening in the world. And it was a sense of, like, low-grade panic. And I think at the same time, there was also the sense that, like, something profound is changing here. And at around that time was when I also realized that there was a student newspaper on campus. And I started to make the connection that this could be a way out in terms of vocation, that I could be able to write and make a living off of writing. via this means that otherwise I hadn't thought about. And now that I saw the world was changing, I sort of put those two things together and thought, well, I could write about this. I could write about the world changing. But I would love to tell you that I had any idea at all where the next few years would go. I did not, not even a little. But it did sort of alter that trajectory as well, because I ended up joining the student newspaper. And as a result of that, I landed the only job I've ever had, which was as a full-time journalist for the next 10 years after I graduated.
What impact did September 11 have on your father?
So at the time, my father, you know, he spent years in Canada really struggling to find work because a lot of his credentials weren't recognized. He had no work experience in this part of the world. And so eventually he had landed this job offer in Wisconsin, of all places. So he was going to move to the U.S. It was this hotel in Wisconsin. My dad was an accountant by training, and he was going to do finances at this hotel. And he was quite happy about this. And everything had sort of been, you know, signed and ready to go. All that was necessary was to just complete the visa stuff, you know, the work permit and sort of to straighten all of that out. And that was supposed to be completed, you know, around the first or second week of September in 2001. And then very quickly, there was radio silence. And eventually, the person who was responsible for the job offer had to call up my dad and say, look, it's becoming pretty clear that a guy named Mohammed with your background is not going to get this paperwork sorted out. And we got to move on. And, you know, this stuff happens. Again, I'm sure many of your listeners have their version of something like this. But it was one of those moments where there's sort of a phantom fork in the road and you can see some alternate version of yourself possibly going down that road, but that road has been blocked off. And I think about that a lot because for my father especially, there were a lot of phantom forks in the road. But this one would have really altered the trajectory of all of our lives. But then just like in that airport going to Libya when I was, you know, four or whatever, something bigger, something you can't control, steps in and you have to live the life you live. You can't keep thinking about that phantom life anymore.
During your time as a journalist, you reported from Afghanistan, from the courts in Guantanamo Bay. You covered a major terrorism trial in Canada. You went to Egypt during the Arab Spring and reported on the Black Lives Matter protests. You've described those years as an education. What would you say the lessons of that education were for you?
That's a really good question, and there are multiple answers, some of them fairly straightforward. It was a technical writing education. I am a very purple writer. I spend way too much time describing what the sky is doing. That is not a good fit when you work in a newspaper full of very unsentimental back desk editors. I remember my first day at the Globe and Mail, which is the national paper in Canada. This guy, Greg O'Neill, who had been there for like 30, 40 years, he was the dean of the back desk editors. He sat me down. He said, listen, kid, I'm going to tell you what I tell every new journalist who walks into this room. At the Globe and Mail, all of the reporters are gods and all of the editors are atheists. And it was his way of describing what was about to happen to my copy. And so 10 years of having that impulse beaten out of you did me a lot of good. It was also an education in history and how history happens in real time. It was a chance to parachute into multiple different vocations. This to me is the primary benefit of being a journalist. You get to jump into other people's lives, other people's professions. You get these mini educations. But it was also an education in the grand narratives of the world. There were many situations in which I saw echoes that I couldn't unsee. The first time I ever saw a light armored vehicle was in Afghanistan. The second time I saw a light armored vehicle, or the next instance, was in Ferguson, Missouri. And it was probably being run by a police department. The two times I was tear gassed was in the Arab Spring, and then again in Ferguson, Missouri. And that's not to say that being in one of those places gives you some heightened understanding of the other, only that you start to see these echoes and you can't unsee them, and they shape the way you think about the world and the way violence and state power in particular works in the world. And so for me, that was all of that was the education that I never got in college because I was a useless student. Those 10 years fundamentally shifted the way I think about virtually every facet of the world and my place in it.
Your first two published books are novels. Why is it, do you think, that your reaction to what's happened in Gaza after October 2023, why did you choose the form of writing that you chose to address that?
I often describe writing as sort of my first avenue of retreat. I'm not particularly good in the world. What I mean by that is, you know how they describe some people, you know, who walk into the room and the room lights up? I walk into the room and the exact opposite happens. People think the electricity is cut out for a little bit. You know, that's not me, right? Whenever the world doesn't make sense to me, I turn to the page and I try to figure it out there, and I never do, but that's where I go. I think there are a couple of factors that moved me into nonfiction. I think that for me, fiction is a very slow marinating thing. Both of my published novels, from the first time I started thinking about them to when I had a first draft, that's about 10 years, basically. And what I was witnessing starting in the fall of 2023 was, I think, something that was going to tear me apart if I waited the 10 years and then tried to fictionalize it. That's not to say that the result is a better or worse book. The result is almost certainly a worse book. But I had to sit there with it, and I had to put it down on paper, and this was the form I chose. The other aspect of this is, to be perfectly honest with you, I didn't think there was a chance in hell that this book was actually going to see the light of day. And for me, it was purely just sitting there and trying to work out the anger and the rage and the grief in the only media that I know how to do that in. It wasn't until months later, when I had something like a draft, that I ended up flying to New York and meeting with the folks at Knopf. And that was a tense meeting, or at least my impression of it was that it was tense. And I didn't think that they would want it, and then they did. But by then, you'd done the thing. It was too late to go backwards and think about it. So that's how I ended up in the mode that I was writing in. But there was nothing sort of overarching in terms of, you know, this is how my career arc is going to go or anything like that. I was furious, and I was full of grief, and I needed a place to go, and this is where I ended up.
Omar El-Akkad, as well as the palpable fury and grief, I think a dominant note of One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This is this theme of negation. And also, you write quite a lot towards the end of the book of the idea of walking away, to walk away from a system which has embraced negation, as you describe it. When you walk away from that system, where do you feel you're walking to?
Sometimes, if I'm being honest, the answer is I have no idea. And this is the difficulty, right? So to give you a very trivial example of what I'm talking about, I've been on tour for this book for months now, and the final stop of the Canadian leg of the tour was in Vancouver at the Vancouver Public Library at one of their branches. And leading up to my visit, the administrators there had taken this ludicrous step of trying to ban their employees from wearing watermelon pins or wearing keffiyehs, using a plainly bad faith interpretation of one of their existing laws or sort of codes of conduct or whatever it might be. And people pushed back against it. And eventually there was this even more ridiculous kind of decree that you could do this so long as you were an employee who was Palestinian or spoke Palestinian Arabic. I have no idea who the hell at the Vancouver Public Library was going around to check people's accents. I don't know. The whole thing was ludicrous. And I was asked by activists, since my event was coming up, to try and address this in some way. And of course I said, yeah, absolutely. And then there was some real discussion about what to do. Do I cancel my event in protest? Do I continue with my event and use it as a platform to speak out about this? And I wish I could tell you there was consensus, and there wasn't. And not only is there not consensus between multiple people, I have had different instances where I've made different decisions. There was a festival in Arizona where I found out that one of the chief sponsors was a weapons maker, and I said, I don't want to go to this. Was that the correct decision? Was the correct decision to actually go and raise hell about it? I don't know. I wish I had an algorithmic approach for this. What I do know is that as far as the asymmetry of power goes between the individual or the community and the state, that kind of negative resistance, what you choose not to buy, what you choose not to participate in, is much more difficult to punish. It's much more difficult to punish you for what you don't do. And I also know that there have been many situations where I have decided to stay in the room, and some of these rooms had real power in them, because I wanted to change the room. And I thought my presence there might do that. And then eventually I had to come to the conclusion that what was actually happening was that the room was changing me. And so I have to contend with all of these things and I have to make a decision. But a lot of the time, I have no idea if it's the right decision. And I don't think anybody can really sort of say with 100% certainty what the correct thing to do to resist something as overwhelming as a genocide. I genuinely don't know.
Well, Omar, it's been fascinating speaking with you today. Thank you so much for joining us on The Year That Made Me.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Omar El-Akkad is the author of One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This. And Omar, we always finish The Year That Made Me by asking for a piece of music. What have you chosen for us now?
It's cheating because it's very relevant to 2001, but it's not from 2001. I think it's from the earlier mid-90s, and it's a song called Roads by Portishead, which in addition to being one of the most beautiful and sad songs I've ever heard in my life, was the subject of the terrible, terrible story I wrote that got me into that creative writing class.
Well, here it is. It's a good thing we're listening to the song and not reading the piece of writing. But now, with thanks again, Omar, here's Roads by Portishead.
Listen to more great stories that take you beyond the headlines. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.